From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Will Super Bowl XLIII be entirely for the birds? Well, not if the Steelers win tomorrow. Ahead on Only a Game, Pittsburgh's chances against the Ravens in the AFC title game, and the Eagles' prospects against the surprising Cardinals. Also, Mike Ditka's gridiron greats rushes in to assist former NFL players, and driving and putting on the Ho Chi Minh Golf Trail. Also ahead, University of the Cumberland's grapplers advance their sport and dispel myths.
When you say women wrestler, you know, most people, first of all, are shocked that there is women's wrestling. And then they expect it to be, you know, some giant woman, you know, covered in hair. And they think that, you know, they're just some kind of a brute.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. High-flying eagles, ravens croaking, if not croaked, Steelers in the cards? That was a pre-Super Bowl haiku, a kind of warning of what's to come in a couple of weeks. Joining me now to discuss tomorrow's conference championship games and how the teams involved reached those games is Peter King, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. Peter, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. Great to be with you.
There's been no shortage of unlikely storylines in the NFL playoffs this year. Arizona will host the Philadelphia Eagles in the NFC Championship. Arizona was expected to improve this year, but can anyone honestly say that they predicted the Cardinals would be one win away from the Super Bowl?
No, this is the NFL's version of the Rays getting to the World Series, really, Bill. In the last 6 weeks of the season, they lost games by 21, 28, and 40 points. And the only reason they won their division, the NFC West, is because it was such a weak division. But after the Cardinals lost in New England 47-7 in the second-to-last week of the season, Ken Whisenant, their young coach, stood in the locker room after the game and said basically that was a disgrace. And this week in practice, we're going to begin to determine who's actually going to play in our playoff game in a couple of weeks. So if you want to play, you better show up ready to practice. And they have been basically a reborn team. And, Bill, this won't be the first time that any sports franchise has done this, but all of a sudden the media are the bad guys. We're the ones who've motivated them by saying all the horrible things that we all said about the Cardinals. So that's what's happened in Arizona.
Cardinals quarterback Kurt Warner seems to love being the underdog. After playing in the Arena Football League, he became a two-time NFL MVP, Super Bowl champ with the St. Louis Rams, then injuries and decreased productivity reduced him to a backup role. Now he's having his best year since 2001. How did Warner find his way back to the top?
When he was in St. Louis early this decade, he had a bunch of great receivers who could get open down the field. He had a good arm, and he'd just air it out, and his guys would run under it. Now he's got two superb downfield receivers, Larry Fitzgerald and Anquan Boldin. He's been doing a lot of the same stuff in Arizona, and he also took advantage of the fact that the young kid who they drafted to be the quarterback of the future 3 years ago, Matt Leinart, has really struggled ever since he got to Arizona, personally and professionally. And the other thing in Kurt's life, he has always felt, since about 2002 really, that football gave up on him too soon. So he's now getting the opportunity to prove a lot of his detractors over the last few years wrong. So that he fits in very, very well with this Arizona team.
The Eagles are making their fifth trip to the NFC Championship in the past 8 years, but Philadelphia was in a tailspin as recently as late November. Will their playoff run silence critics of both head coach Andy Reid and their quarterback Donovan McNabb?
Most of them, I think, but anything short of winning a Super Bowl, they will have their critics in Philadelphia. But here's the thing about Donovan McNabb. There was much hue and cry when Andy Reid, at halftime of a horrible performance at Baltimore in mid-November, benched him and put in a young kid, Kevin Cobb. And a lot of people said that, well, Andy Reid, you know, had a quick hook with his quarterback of 10 years, and he shouldn't have done this. But this really has helped McNabb. It's helped him focus and become totally determined. Well, I'm going to show my head coach, and I'm going to show this fan base that thinks I'm washed up.
It sounds to me as if this is shaping up as the playoffs of the quarterbacks wishing to prove that they should still be there.
Yeah, exactly. I think in the NFC, it's clearly that. I mean, in the AFC, you've got the diaper bowl among quarterbacks. You got the two real young guys. But, yeah, in the NFC, it's a couple of quarterbacks, I think, looking to prove that they're still premier players and some of their critics believing that they aren't.
Turning to the AFC, the Baltimore Ravens upset the Tennessee Titans Saturday. They visit the Pittsburgh Steelers in the AFC Championship game. Ravens head coach John Harbaugh and quarterback Joe Flacco are both rookies. Maybe they've forgotten that.
I mean, Joe Flacco, it's amazing watching him. I covered their game last weekend in Nashville, and the Joe Flacco you're going to see on the field tomorrow is more of a seven-year veteran than a rookie. Not only has he engineered two playoff victories for Baltimore, he hasn't turned the ball over nor taken a sack in either one of the games. So he's obviously extremely poised and has not been bothered by two very difficult, loud, ruckus road crowds here in the playoffs so far.
The Steelers took a more conventional road to the conference championship. They finished the regular season 12-4. They won the AFC North for the second straight year. They earned a first-round playoff bye. Of the four teams left, is Pittsburgh the one to beat?
I think so. Willie Parker, their Pro Bowl running back from last year, is back healthy. Ben Roethlisberger has developed a new weapon at wide receiver in Santonio Holmes to accompany Hines Ward. And their defense is the best defense in the league, and it's healthy.
All right, Peter, it sounds as if you think that the Pittsburgh Steelers will be one of the teams in the Super Bowl.
Yes.
And it sounds as if you think the Pittsburgh Steelers will win the Super Bowl. Who do they get to beat?
I think it'll be Philadelphia. I think we're going to have a Keystone State Super Bowl, Bill. I think one of the things that Philadelphia has is a team that is determined and a team that we didn't talk about their defense very much, but their defense is rising up right now and playing great both against the run and against the pass right now, and I just don't think Arizona is going to be able to mount much of an offensive attack against them.
Peter King is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, and he writes the Monday Morning Quarterback column about the NFL for SI.com. Peter, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Super Bowl excitement is building in Tampa. One of the people promising a great party is former NFL player and Chicago Bears head coach Mike Ditka. His nonprofit group, Gridiron Greats, assists former players hit hard by medical and financial troubles. The organization has planned several fundraising events in conjunction with the Super Bowl. From Tampa, Bobby O'Brien reports.
From the start of my career till now, I've had 30 operations, and recently I've had eight. My knees and hips replaced.
Offensive lineman Pat Mattson played 10 years in the NFL for Denver, Cincinnati, and Green Bay. He has qualified for Social Security disability benefits, but in November, Mattson was still battling to take advantage of the NFL's disability program.
Gridiron Greats has been really good to me. The National Football League players kind of turned their back on me and really weren't there. There was no disability at all.
Gridiron Greats is a nonprofit organization that helps retired players like Mattson pay medical bills or rent and even buys food. Mike Ditka is the first to tell you he didn't start the group. He stepped in after learning how some former greats were barely surviving. In November, he held a press conference in Tampa to raise awareness over the plight of former NFL players.
Gang is silly. They're living in shelters. They got no food. They can't get medicine. How the hell can this happen? But it happens.
Ditka says many older players are suffering from injuries sustained during their NFL careers, but they are unable to qualify for the league's disability programs while medical problems drain their savings and endanger their lives.
In the old days, sports medicine was antiquated. The doctors were owned by the teams, period. Cut and dried. You got knocked out. This was your test. You could say three, your ass was back in there. And it wasn't complicated. Jack Youngbark played a football game with a broken ankle. taped it up, played. You don't see that stuff today.
Hall of Fame defensive lineman Jack Youngblood played 14 seasons for the Los Angeles Rams and is one of more than 100 former players supporting Ditka's efforts.
Isn't it amazing that Mike Ditka has had to take up this cause and answer the issues and solve the problems for a $7 billion industry? We're just getting started on doing what we think is right to do.
Currently, the Gridiron Greats office fields about 20 requests each month from retired players in need. Again, Mike Ditka.
The disability program in the National Football League is a farce. And anybody that denies that is a joke. Period. Now, whether they like that or not, that's the way it is.
Ditka says the system is rigged because it requires a unanimous vote from six panelists to approve a disability claim. Half represent the owners and half the Players Association.
Why wouldn't you get six independent specialist doctors, the best in the country, put them on a panel and let them make this determination, separate from NFL ownership, separate from the Players Association, and abide by their ruling? This would make too much sense because these guys would know what the hell they're doing. They wouldn't be paid by the Players Association or the NFL. And that to me bothers me.
Late last year, the Gridiron Greats organization estimated that of more than 1,100 applicants, only 40 so far have been granted NFL disability status. NFL Vice President for Marketing Greg Aiello says he cannot confirm those numbers, but also says the NFL is open to improving the system.
Sensitive to concerns that those eligibility requirements and the screening be handled properly, and if they can be improved, we want to improve it, and that's what we're working at. But there have to be standards, and people have to meet those standards to qualify for these benefits.
The benefits and pay scale for the old-timers are vastly different from those enjoyed by today's players. Hall of Fame running back Gale Sayers remembers battling like dogs to win the Pro Bowl, the NFL's version of an All-Star game, because it meant an extra $1,000. He says today winners get $25,000 each. Sayers thinks it is essential to get active players involved in changing the system.
We're going to continue to work on these younger players because they can get hurt. Many of them has gotten hurt. They're going to start thinking about, well, what if I get hurt? You know, who's going to take care of me? They're going to come our way.
Ideally, Sayers would like to see owners step up and help their former players. But until then, he, Ditka, and hundreds of others will donate their time and money to keep their teammates going. And that takes money that they hope to raise with a series of events during Super Bowl week. For Only a Game, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Eric Akerstein holds one Rubik's Cube record. He solved it in 7.08 seconds. This week, Graham Parker of Hampshire in the UK established the other Rubik's Cube record when he solved it after 26 years of attempting to do so. "It drove me mad and took over my life," Mr. Parker said. "I missed important events to stay in and solve it. Friends offered to do it for me, but I had to do it myself. I had wrist and back problems from spending hours on it, but it was all worth it. When I clicked that last bit and each face was a solid color, I wept." Mr. Parker's wife confirmed her husband's obsession. "I was going to get rid of it," she said, "but I knew he wouldn't rest until he solved it." I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a look at the top women's wrestling program in the country. But first, traditional golf vacations require travel to Florida, California, perhaps Augusta, Georgia, or even Scotland for a few scenic rounds. Ron Chambers of Apex, North Carolina, recently traveled 9,000 miles to try out some of the courses in a country that's recently been luring linksters, Vietnam. In the February edition of Golf Magazine, Michael Walker Jr. writes about the rounds Chambers played in the country he had last visited as a Marine. Michael Walker Jr. joins me now from NPR in New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
And we're also joined by Ron Chambers from Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
Ron, whose idea was it for you to return to Vietnam as a golfer 40 years after you had left the country?
It was Golf Magazine's idea. I think it's a story idea that Michael had.
And did you actually play? I just have to get this straight. Did you actually play on courses that were part of something called the Ho Chi Minh Golf Trail?
Well, yes. Yes, we did, actually. I'm not sure the trail ran right through the first fairway, but they were very close.
Michael, can you describe what it's like to arrive at one of those golf resorts?
Oh, certainly, certainly. I think the real place you saw how dramatic it was in Da Nang. You come back there, it's a beachside resort, so it's really where a lot of the focus of the redevelopment's going. It's like you might imagine what Cancun looked like in 1970 when they sort of just picked out where the big beach resort would be. There's huge signs, there's like hotel coming here, hotel coming there. They're actually moving, relocating graveyards to build hotels and golf courses, and all this coastal land they're hoping will become this great place for these golf destinations and beach resorts. And to just drive through it and then think, you know, this is Da Nang, this is where all these things in the war happened. It's almost surreal.
Michael, in the article you write that there were a couple of moments when you saw Ron, who is 65 and a book publisher now, suddenly begin to look more like a 25-year-old Marine. Can you describe those moments?
Yes, it was really interesting. One of the courses we were on had a bunker that the French had built during the previous Vietnam War that the American troops used later. And Ron went down inside to sort of show us how they were being used in the Vietnam War. And as he went down, he talked faster, his movements seemed to quicken. It was just as if the memories coming back sort of brought him back to a different place. And it was just really remarkable to watch.
Ron, is that something you were aware of at the time, that you were talking more quickly and your movements were changing?
Not really, not until Michael told me later. But when I got down there and suddenly I just remembered all the military stuff that you learn, and I was explaining to them about the fields of fire out of the bunker and things like that, I didn't quite know where it all came from, really. I hadn't thought about it for years.
Ron, at one point during your trip when you were not on the golf course, you met with a man named Phan Van Dung who had fought for the Viet Cong in some of the same areas where you had been stationed. Of that experience, you said, quote, "I felt comradeship." Did that feeling surprise you?
Yes, it did. We were pretty bitter enemies back in the day, and although that's been a long time ago now, he was very cordial toward me, and I was the same towards him. Mm-hmm. But when you look around Vietnam, I mean, 70% of the people are under 30, and only old guys like us even remember the war. And we both sort of looked at each other, and we realized that I think we both simultaneously felt some comradeship.
Michael, you found that at least some of the golf resorts, and there are a lot of them, that have appeared in Vietnam are trolling for pretty well-heeled golfers. Rooms at the Nam Hai Hotel in Da Nang start at what?
Oh, I think they were starting at maybe $500-$600. I mean, when you go into these hotels and these golf courses, I mean, it's really online of what you'd expect to see in a really nice resort outside Scottsdale or maybe Cabo. They're definitely not going after your weekend golfer, your daily golfer, but these are, you know, targeted for businessmen in Asia taking trips over, and certainly, you know, more adventurous Americans who might take a trip over. But this is a high-end golf destination. Mm. It's not for, you know, the ham and egger weekend round.
Well, I wonder if you're anticipating that your article will result in more golfers from the U.S. heading for the Ho Chi Minh Golf Trail.
I think it would put it in people's head as a destination. It's still a long flight. It's a long way from home. But I think, yeah, sure, adventurous golfers who want to go to different places, and particularly men like Ron who have these memories from back then, yeah, I'd hope to see more people going over there, absolutely.
Ron, I would think the memories from back then angle might cut both ways. Did you have any hesitation to going back to Vietnam?
Not at all. Initially, when Golf Magazine and Michael invited me, I was very excited. But curiously, just as I was getting ready to go to the airport I began to get really apprehensive. I mean, rationally, I knew I was going on a vacation to play golf, but sort of subconsciously, I began to get nervous, agitated. I mean, I looked on the floor, and there's my golf bag. It was not a Marine Corps sea bag, but it was a very strange feeling, and I suddenly found myself thinking, oh, I wish this was over. Why did I want to do this? Because I had those same feelings I had in 1967 as I left. You know, apprehension, probably some fear, and I was having it all over again. But it left after I got underway.
At one point in the article, Michael writes that you said, I keep asking myself, why does anyone fight wars? Can you imagine that someday, 40 or so years from now, some former U.S. soldier will be playing golf in Baghdad and maybe asking him or herself the same thing?
I absolutely can imagine that. I hope it'll happen.
Ron Chambers, ex-Marine and current golfer, joined me from Raleigh, North Carolina. Ron, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
And Michael Walker Jr., who wrote the story of the trip Ron Chambers took to Vietnam for the February issue of Golf Magazine, joined me from NPR New York. Michael, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having us, Bill.
College wrestling has become one of the NCAA's most endangered sports. Over the past few decades, almost 200 wrestling programs have folded as schools have made budget cuts or trimmed men's teams to balance male and female athletic participation under the federal Title IX law. But as Ron Schachter found in a recent visit to University of the Cumberlands in Williamsburg, Kentucky, college wrestling is establishing itself in some unexpected places and with some unlikely competitors.
A granite version of the Ten Commandments guards the main entrance at the University of the Cumberlands in the rural southeastern corner of Kentucky. For better than a century, this school has stuck to its mission of educating students in its own neck of Appalachia. But 10 years ago, UC President Jim Taylor, a former high school wrestler himself, made the unorthodox move of creating a women's wrestling team.
So I thought it was a nice way for us to get exposure and some visibility, and it's turned out to be just exactly that. Some of our better students are lady wrestlers, and they come here from all over the country, and they've been able to compete nationally and internationally and even represent the institution at the Olympics. So that gives us some visibility, as it turns out, that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
Nowadays, Taylor fields calls from other college presidents interested in starting a women's team of their own, and the UC wrestlers have become a juggernaut, winning 3 consecutive collegiate championships. Granted that with the addition this season of women's programs at Missouri Baptist University and Jamestown College in North Dakota, the League of Women Collegiate Wrestlers numbers all of 9 teams, but UC's accomplishments have placed the university on the national map. Kip Flanick has coached women's wrestling here for the past 7 years.
When you say women wrestler, you know, most people, first of all, are shocked that there is women's wrestling, and then they expect it to be, you know, some giant woman, you know, covered in hair, and they think that, you know, they're just some kind of a brute.
But the misconceptions have faded as Flanick's roster has grown from 6 to more than 60, which he says is the largest collegiate women's team in the world. In the process, UC Wrestling has taken on some of the trappings of a big-time sports program, crisscrossing the country to compete and offering many of its members close to a full ride on their tuition.
You know, the nice thing here is I have the opportunity to give scholarships to many, many girls, and they haven't told me to stop. You know, we don't give out full scholarships, but between financial aid and academic scholarships and athletic scholarships, we can make it affordable for most kids to come here.
Flanick finds almost half of his team in Texas, Hawaii, and Washington State, which offer high school programs and state tournaments for girls. The rest come from high schools around the country where they've honed their skills competing against boys. That's how UC alumna and assistant coach Takara Montgomery got started a decade ago at the Cleveland High School where Flanick coached. Montgomery, who already played 4 sports, wanted to try something different. So starting in her sophomore year, she split the winter season between wrestling and the girls' basketball team on which she was a star power forward.
Playing basketball, we were number 1 team in the city, like number 2 in the state. And, you know, I'm just used to winning. And then I started wrestling, and just the first year was rough. It was loss after loss. And even close matches where, you know, I felt like I should have won, the other or more experienced person that I was wrestling more often, it was a guy, just outmatched me and I lost again.
By her senior year, she was winning consistently and relying on technique and mental toughness to offset the superior strength of her male opponents.
Nobody at the time wanted to wrestle a girl, not in a disrespectful tone or anything like that, but, I mean, it's tough for a guy. You got to wrestle a girl. It's a lose-lose situation. If you beat her, you just beat a girl, big whoop, you know. If you lost to a girl, I mean, that's just the ultimate negative impact on a guy to lose to a girl. I mean, I just, not to dwell on it, but there are guys who cried or got really angry and would storm off and didn't really know how to deal with the stress of that.
Montgomery went on to star at University of the Cumberlands, one of only three women's wrestling teams in the country when she arrived in 2001. And 3 years later, at 158 pounds, she made the U.S. squad for the first women's wrestling competition at the Athens Olympics.
So we're here, you bang her down, and then you're right into it. There is no pause. There is no pause. Give it a try. 3, 2, 1.
When Montgomery dispenses instruction at the start of afternoon practice on the second floor of a former National Guard armory, the women wrestlers listen. Practices are otherwise an exercise in perpetual motion, starting with accelerating laps around the perimeter of the almost wall-to-wall red wrestling mats and punctuated by high stepping and shoulder rolls. Today, the women have already worked out at 6 a.m., and every night at 9, there's a voluntary open mat session. After warm-ups, half the wrestlers choose partners in their weight classes from 92 pounds to 180, and scrimmage on the mats in a flurry of takedowns, escapes, and reversals. The remainder jump rope nonstop. After 3 2-minute sessions on the mat, the length of a standard match, scrimmagers and rope jumpers trade positions again and again without a break.
Ready!
...121-pound junior Norma Rueda from El Paso, Texas, says that her teammates' work ethic and overall success have made them the big women on campus.
We're the tough girls around here, pretty much. They see us together like, oh, let's get away from them because they're going to beat us up or something like that. Coach says we're the Spartans of the sports.
The UC women also endure a challenging travel schedule, heading regularly to Oklahoma, Missouri, California, and North Dakota, not to mention tournaments in Ontario and British Columbia, where women's college wrestling is more common. But besides focusing on another collegiate title, Coach Flanick and many of his wrestlers are looking even further ahead. Junior Jackie Stiles won an individual championship and made the junior Pan American team in her freshman year.
I plan on continuing wrestling after college. I mean, I really would like to make the Olympic team and, you know, world teams, as many teams as I could make.
Flanick is hoping to grow the sport in the United States. So far, it's fallen to the smaller colleges competing in the National Association of Intercollegiate Athletics to field teams. And while more than 5,000 girls wrestle at the high school level, Flanick notes that won't be a sufficient recruiting pool to attract the interest of the nation's larger NCAA schools.
Hopefully, we'll head more towards separate women's divisions in every state, and then hopefully we'll find more and more coaches who are willing to accept and to coach these girls. I think the more we graduate girls from college, the more opportunities there will be for these women to go back and coach other girls and, you know, give them the full attention that they need.
In 2 weeks, the University of the Cumberlands hits the road again to defend its title at the College Nationals in Marshall, Missouri. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Williamsburg, Kentucky.
You're listening to Only a Game. Last week's story about Katie Burt, the 11-year-old sixth grader playing goalie for the girls' ice hockey team at Lynn English High School, provoked this response from Molly Yurden, who hears Only a Game on WRVO in Lacona, New York. As a longtime coach, I have used the State High School Athletic Association process to selectively classify 7th and 8th grade girls to play at the high school level. My understanding has always been that the purpose of the program is to allow a player with exceptional skill to move up to a higher level, not, as one coach suggested, to fill out a high school team without enough players. That is putting the program ahead of the player, and that is not what school athletics is supposed to be about. For the record, in this particular case, Katie Burt's skills have not been in doubt, and she was asked to join the team because the regular goalie was injured. Last week, I discussed with Mark Barrowcliffe his new book, The Elfish Gene, in which he chronicles his years as a devotee of the fantasy game Dungeons and Dragons. Stephen Balzac of Stowe, Massachusetts, was not entirely pleased. I listened to your discussion of The Elfish Gene with a mixture of amusement and disgust, he wrote. The idea of role-playing games as a silly diversion for geeky boys is old, tired, and wrong. I started playing D&D over 30 years ago. Today, I use serious live role-playing predictive scenarios as part of my consulting work. I ran a pandemic flu predictive scenario exercise in Washington, D.C. How people behave in a game corresponds remarkably well to how they'll behave in similar real-life scenarios. Another listener, who identified herself as Dragonwing, took exception to Mark Barrowcliffe's characterization of Dungeons & Dragons as a boys' game. There's a strong group of women in the D&D and general geek culture, Dragonwing wrote. D&D introduced me to my husband and my closest group of friends ever. If I wasn't a D&D girl, I'd never have found out how happy I was being a geek. The game is a wonderful release for those little repressed parts of your soul that you don't know how to express. Be you nerd, geek, dragon wing, or none of the above, know ye that you can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860, or you can send us a letter or a postcard at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Tomorrow, the Pittsburgh Steelers will play the Baltimore Ravens for the right to advance to the Super Bowl. That means on Monday, the mayor of Pittsburgh can reclaim his name. On Wednesday morning, Luke Ravenstahl, the youngest mayor of a major city in the U.S., heard that callers to a local radio station had been suggesting that he change his name to Luke Steelerstahl in support of the home team. Always happy to oblige constituents, Ravenstahl began the name change process on Wednesday. As soon as I heard it, I thought it was a great idea, said the mayor. Since Stahl is German for steel, his honor could currently be addressed as Mayor Steelerstahl. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the collected stories of athletes who've reclaimed glory they never should have lost. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Did they put it on eBay?
You'll have to just listen
okay.
and find out.
All right. We'll continue.
Listen, you did well enough with your NFL playoff picks to earn a chance to predict the winners of tomorrow's conference championship game. So, who goes to the Super Bowl?
The Eagles go to the Super Bowl. We have a remarkable number of birds this year. Have you noticed three of the four are birds?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Was that Nevermore?
That was a raven.
Nevermore. Nevermore. Unfortunately, the Nevermores are going to lose, I think. It is the Steelers' year, I believe. I think the Steelers will win. I am not as confident in that pick as I am in saying that the Eagles will beat the Cardinals.
So you're talking an all-Pennsylvania Super Bowl.
That's right, an all-Pennsylvania Super Bowl. That's right.
On Monday, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reported that the injury Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger suffered in the final regular season game was more serious than the team had previously reported.
No!
Spinal cord concussion does sound serious, doesn't it?
Well, I hate to diminish the television courage it takes for this to go on, but Ben Roethlisberger is a moron, and so is the whole medical staff of the Pittsburgh Steelers, and so is anybody who cheers for him this weekend. How often do these guys have to go through this before they realize what they can do to themselves here? This was incredibly dangerous. Him continuing to play is incredibly dangerous, and people should at least take that into account.
Charlie, most of the coaching change stories at the end of the year come as a result of firings, of course, but not in Indianapolis, where the Colts would have been delighted to retain Tony Dungy, but I guess Mr. Dungy feels that he has other things to accomplish.
Yes, I believe he's going to go to Galilee and catch fish for a while. he's leaving. He's going to become a prominent speaker on the family values circuit, apparently. Interesting career there. Always had a really good team. Won one Super Bowl. Maybe should have won a couple more. Ran into the New England Patriots at the wrong time.
University of Tennessee women's basketball team lost to Vanderbilt on Sunday, after which the Vols fell to number 13 in the nation. This is the lowest they've been in 23 years. What's going on in Knoxville?
I think they're in a slump, but I think by the end of the year they'll be back where they should be. You know, this is just an interesting year. There are now suddenly enough good women's teams in the country that Tennessee can have a down year.
Records are made to be broken, and an NBA record fell on Tuesday night, courtesy of the Orlando Magic. I wish I'd been at this game. The Orlando Magic made 23 three-pointers. Will the rest of the league start paying attention to what Orlando's been accomplishing in relative anonymity this season?
To whom on the Orlando Magic did they give the big stuffed goat, do you think? 23 threes.
Don't they teach kids to shoot layups anymore?
And not just that, but in a rout. I mean, they're still firing. This game was 139-107.
I wish I'd been there. Houston Rocket center Yao Ming once said that the trouble with basketball back home is the lack of physical play. Do you think he's second-guessing himself now that chaos reigns on Chinese basketball courts?
This is the law of unintended consequences in a very interesting way. When Yao and the team got beat in the Beijing Olympics last time in the quarterfinals, the CBA decided that the reason that they lost so soon in the tournament was they weren't physical enough. So a ton of prevention to an ounce of cure, decided they were going to get physical. Now every game is deteriorating into a brawl. They've handed out $140,000 in fines this year.
And my favorite part of this story is the fans are involved.
Of course, it wasn't made clear to them that they're not involved.
Too.
And also, not that this isn't a universal problem, one of the problems that this has also exposed is the fact that the refereeing in China is really bad.
Elsewhere on the record watch, perhaps you'd like to handle the tip of the Only a Game cap to Northern State University men's basketball coach Don Meyer.
Aberdeen, South Dakota, by the way, should anyone ask. He won his 903rd game, which makes him the winningest coach in all of college basketball's many divisions. The one thing I'm intrigued by is that Northern State was actually an opponent played by Chip Hilton's state squad in the Chip Hilton sports book. So this is both a fictional and real school.
On Monday, the Australian Open will get underway for the first time in
what?
5 years. Yes.
Are you serious?
And Roger
it's
Federer
tennis season?
Will not. It's always tennis season. Roger Federer will not be seeded first this time around. Rafael Nadal will. How do you like his chances?
I like his chances very well. This is a very interesting season for Federer. This is the make or break season. Now he is no longer number one. And if the torch has really been passed, we're going to find out between now and Wimbledon, I'm fairly sure.
Sidney Wood, the only man ever to win Wimbledon by default, died this week. He was 97 years old and by all accounts had a full and rewarding life, and he participated in some pretty good tennis stories in his day, too.
The only man ever to win Wimbledon in a walkover, and he got a walkover because Frank Shields, who was also his Davis Cup teammate, had sprained a knee in the semifinals, and the American tennis officials, you know, at that point, control over the players was fully dictatorial, told him to default the final so he'd be available for a Davis Cup match against Britain in 2 weeks. And Wood went crazy. He wouldn't even accept the trophy. He gave it to a friend of his to hold until he came back and beat Frank Shields, who was the guy who defaulted for him, and then he wanted the trophy back, and the person he gave it to wouldn't give it to him.
Well, she liked it by that time. We can't blame her. Mayor Richard Daley's request for more taxpayer money to increase Chicago's credibility as a potential host city for the 2016 Olympics was approved by the city council on Tuesday. Do the city's aldermen know something about Obama's economic revival plan that the rest of the country hasn't learned yet?
Correct me if I'm wrong. I occasionally stumble into the front part of the newspaper. Aren't there certain fiscal irregularities in Illinois that should make us all a little dubious about this kind of thing?
Unanimously approved.
I'm shocked to learn that they're giving away money. Can I go to Chicago the day where they just pile up all the currency in front of City Hall and light it on fire?
Tuesday is Inauguration Day, and so it's a good time to mention yet another excellent minor league baseball team promotion. On June 23rd, the Brooklyn Cyclones will change their name to
the Barackland Cyclones, and they're going to give out Barack Obama bobbleheads. All fans named Barack get in for free, and fans named McCain or Palin get free bleacher seats, and any plumber named Joe gets two free tickets. So this is an admirably bipartisan stimulus package.
It's going to be a full house, no question about it. Finally, Charlie, thanks to the fact that Florida beat Oklahoma in the BCS title game on January 8th, I understand that Senator Tom Coburn, R. Oklahoma, will have the pleasure of belting out a ditty usually associated with Elton John and William Shatner.
Yes, he's got to sing Rocket Man to Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of Florida, who was going to have to sing Oklahoma if Florida won. Okay, this is one of these stupid bets that politicians make. But at least, you know, he's not singing, you know, Take Me to the Pilot or Candle in the Wind or something.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game occasionally to sing. Thank you, Charlie.
You're lying about it being tennis season. I know you are.
I think it's going to be a long, long time. And I think it's going to be a long, long time. And I think it's going to be a long, long time. And I think it's going to be a long, long time. And I think it's going to be long, long time.
The degree to which athletes represent more than games won and even spirits raised or hopes dashed has often been debated. A new collection of essays titled Reconstructing Fame, Sport, Race, and Evolving Reputations explores the matter by examining how athletes once vilified by segments of society are eventually embraced as heroes and role models. The editors of Reconstructing Fame join me now, Joel Nathan Rosen from the studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Only a Game.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
And on the phone, we have David C. Ogden. David, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Bill.
One premise of the book seems to be that athletes who have been made outcasts when they've been seen as a threat can be celebrated when they're no longer characterized in those terms. Let's consider Curt Flood, for example. He was an all-star with the St. Louis Cardinals during the 60s. Some considered him a threat to the very existence of pro baseball when he protested against the reserve clause by refusing a trade to the Phillies. Your theory is that Flood could only be understood as a brave and admirable man when it had been demonstrated that he wasn't dangerous after all. But didn't a lot of people see Curt Flood, and for that matter, Roberto Clemente and Bill Russell, who were also in the book, as righteous and courageous right from the outset?
There were some who felt that way, certainly, and I think there were some who spoke up, but they weren't obviously the vocal ones. And what these guys have in common too is that they're bucking a trend. It's either a cultural trend, a social trend. They're not fitting into the mold that to which they're cast by the public and by the dominant cultures around them. And so they all shared that pretty much to one extent or another at the beginning of their careers.
It's an interesting phrase that you've used, buck the trend. Certainly that could be said of Bill Russell, who spoke out about racism when most people expected athletes to just be athletes, be entertainers. Clemente's case, I think, is a little more complicated, isn't it?
Well, it is. For one thing, Clemente called himself a, quote, double nigger, unquote. And the reason he did that is because he was being treated in a blue-collar steel town as not only a black man, but somebody who was from another culture and another society. And Henry Aaron said on the documentary Clemente 21 that Clemente probably had it harder than he did because Clemente had not experienced prejudice before, or that was not part of his upbringing. This was pretty new to him. Early on, he was not understood. He couldn't speak English. They would quote him phonetically in the local press, not necessarily to make fun of him, but I don't think they understood him either. And he could be surly at times. He was moody. But the more he adapted to Pittsburgh and the more familiar he became with the United States and society here, et cetera, I think the more he adapted and the more, well, he was less defensive. And the relationship, I think, with the community and press and media improved as the years went on.
The essay on Bill Russell points out that when he was active as a player, Russell, quote, spoke supportively of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. Moving forward, would Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf's 1996 refusal to stand for the national anthem before basketball games in which he was playing constitute sort of a contemporary example of similar independence and courage?
Without question. And I remember seeing when he was Chris Jackson, I remember seeing him at LSU, and you could tell he was a special kid then. You can certainly use, you know, through hindsight, you can say, well, what he did was a very courageous thing. And maybe 20 years from now, people will go back to that and say that was the start of a new trend, of a sort of passive resistance, almost a sort of a king-like resistance to the powers that be and the expectations they had for people that were well outside the parameters of what they believe were just.
Some of our listeners may be less familiar with Paul Robeson than they are with Muhammad Ali, Jackie Robinson, and Curt Flood. What made Robeson, who's really more known for his achievements off the field than on it, a worthy candidate for discussion in your book?
Well, now you've struck a real chord. Because this is, I mean, in many ways, Robeson is, he's the guy. You look at Robeson, and like you say, you know, he is not necessarily known as an athlete, even though if you go back to Dr. Gonono's chapter, he was an extraordinary athlete, 16 letters at Rutgers, at a time when almost nobody did such a thing, and he was a black man at Rutgers doing this, and it was extraordinary. But with him, you come to a really interesting sort of fork in the road, and to paraphrase our man Yogi Berra, right? He took it. He went out of his way to simply say, you know what, just because I don't look like I should be making decisions like this, because I don't fit the Anglo-Saxon ideal, doesn't mean I'm going to back down. I'm educated, I'm talented, I have interests that extend far beyond the physical.
In the essay on Paul Robeson, he's compared to Michael Jordan, and the assertion is that, quote, Robeson became a hero precisely because he was not, in the modern lexicon, Jordan-esque. Does this suggest something about Michael Jordan or about our contemporary standards for heroes?
One of the criticisms of Michael Jordan, and Dr. Rosen can chime in here, was that he abdicated his responsibilities when it came to speaking out about civil rights issues and about issues and problems affecting African Americans.
The thing with Jordan, though, I mean, we're at a time now where I think it's incumbent upon us to start revisiting some of these time-cherished ideals, you know, giving back, speaking out. Isn't the cause of liberation one that suggests, you know what, just because who I am, I don't have to speak out? It's a real interesting subtext to the Jordan saga. Robeson was a man of his time where speaking out was uncommon and unusual. And so what Robeson does is he crosses those lines. Jordan comes around at a time when, you know, some athletes continue to speak out and some simply didn't. And Jordan decided to take the other road. And he looks at the financial landscape and the reputational landscape. And he says, you know, this is not how to build an empire. And I think in some ways we're seeing this in Cleveland with LeBron James.
The afterword of the book takes on the matter of globalization, and at one point maintains that, I'm quoting here, globalization has accelerated, diversified, and intensified the rituals of degradation in sport. How so?
What I took from this, and I thought this was really an extraordinary point, I saw it as a contextual point too. A lot of the way that American sport is packaged, especially now that it's being packaged outside of our borders, takes on a much more problematic nature, because now we're bringing these images of American life that are already stage managed, and now we're stage managing them for cultures that don't necessarily have a foundational understanding of the way things work here. So what this has done now in terms of a global sport marketplace has given the illusion that, well, race, America, no longer a salient issue. Let's look how the athletes are doing. Look at all the money they're making. Look at all the exposure they're getting. Well, that may be so for a handful. But is the question of race been settled? Is the question of race been settled, you know, because you know, a man of color is being inaugurated on Tuesday? I mean, these questions become much more than, as Jack says, local questions. Now they become regional, national, cultural as well as global questions. And I think we're seeing the expansion of the sport marketplace running headlong into the way that reputations are formed, constructed, re-dipped, reconstructed, what have you.
David C. Ogden and Joel Nathan Rosen are the editors of Reconstructing Fame, Sport, Race, and Evolving Reputations, published by the University Press of Mississippi. David, thank you very much for joining me.
Pleasure, Bill.
And Joel, thank you as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Wendy Schwartz and from Brian Fadham. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries past and present, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from singer William Shatner.
I'm a rock it man.
I hear he can act a little bit, too. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.